Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the bookshop. A few months after I relocated to Los Angeles, I was introduced to the Bodhi Tree, a snug bookstore on Melrose Avenue that specialized in books of the enlightening kind. During the mid-90s, owners Phil Thompson and Stan Madison extended their store by taking over a neighboring house which became known as the Bodhi Tree Annex. My introduction to the Bodhi Tree paralleled my personal late-20s search for truth. I remember the first time I wandered in the front door, the scent of Nag Champa drew me in, as if the scent itself was a living entity and sensed I carried my recent paycheck. 2 hours later, I struggled to my Volkswagen Bug with a bag of books on Buddhism and mysticism and another stuffed with large pieces of amethyst and rose-colored quartz, along with an assortment of incense to nurture my every mood. Who needs groceries when enlightenment is but a page away? There were many times during my early LA years where I'd find shelter in the Bodhi Tree bookstore. Maybe it was because it was a beacon for other lost souls, each one of us a work in progress. One time, when no amount of chocolate or red wine took away the blues of homesickness, I wandered into the store and found it to be almost empty. The bookseller at the front desk smiled at me as I walked by. It was the kind of smile my Auntie Ivy used to give me. It was her way of saying, "This too shall pass, darling." After 30 minutes of wandering around the place, past the aromatherapy, candles, pendulums, crystals, and meditation pillows, I headed for the books. I passed by the tarot and angel section, followed by shelves filled with books on past lives, alien lives, indigo children, energy healing, and chakras, until I realized I was back at the psychic section. I looked around, and upon seeing the place was still fairly empty, I whispered, "Give me a sign." Nothing happened. I took a few steps. About 10 feet in front of me, at the end of the aisle, a book shot out of the bookshelf to my right and landed on the floor. I paused mid-step, looked to my right to see if anyone was nearby. There was no one. I stared at the book as if it was an oracle of sorts, before walking quickly to where it lay. The cover was nothing fancy, brown with the drawing of a hand in a yellow frame. The title was written in black and read, "Reaching for the Other Side," and below, in capitals, the name Dawn Hill, her personal journey to the psychic world. I picked up the book, turned to the synopsis and read, "Dawn Hill was born in Launceston, Tasmania." Let me explain the significance of that sentence and what had just happened. I went to the store because I was homesick. I asked for a sign. A book shot out of a bookshelf on its own and landed on the floor in front of me. The author was born in Launceston, Tasmania, the exact town where my family lived, where I grew up and went to school. Out of the thousands of books in the Bodhi Tree, that one landed at my feet. I walked directly to the front desk, paid for the book, and went home. While the book itself wasn't life-changing, the experience was. I realized that there was something to be said for the power of thought. I still have the book. In fact, it's sitting next to me while I write. Maybe I'll give it another read-through and see if there's a gem waiting for me between the pages. The Bodhi Tree Bookstore was an iconic place, and for 40 years it nurtured people like me, the dreamers and creatives, the lost souls in Hollywood. Today, we're in the beautiful town of Woodstock, Vermont, in Vermont's longest-running independent bookshop. Christian Prelowski and Kerry Moich are co-owners of the Yankee Bookshop. I was introduced to Christian and Kerry by author Geza Tretalier, who is my guest a little later in the show. Hi, Christian. Hi, Kerry. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello.
I'd love to hear about the history of the Yankee Bookshop since it first opened in November 1935 and your place in it.
We were told when we purchased the shop, we were the eighth owners.
So we're trying to go back through history, through other resources, through news clippings, newspaper clippings, to determine who owned it when.
And actually, Christian thinks that he may have found another owner in there. So we might actually be the ninth owner.
Some of it because the time, and it wasn't recorded as well in like the 30s, 40s, and 50s, say. And we had a hand with the Woodstock Historical Society as well in putting the pieces together. But as far as for the first owners was the Bordens, Mr. and Mrs. Barry Borden, who came from Prosper, opened it up in 1935. And rumor has it, Barry Borden was, he used to sell books from out of his wood paneled station wagon before he opened up an actual physical bookshop. Again, a lot of this stuff is kind of being filled in by family members of previous owners. The grandchild of the Borden family reached out to us and was trying to also get more history. So he filled us in the details of the early days and of his grandfather selling books. But yeah, we are either the eighth or ninth owners of the shop.
And some of the previous owners are still around. Actually, the couple who owned the shop from 1964 to 73 was Will and Jane Curtis. And they were the authors of a number of books, and he ran a local radio show and everything. And Jane has just celebrated her 102nd mm-hmm. birthday.
102 years, yeah.
And she she lives just down the street. It's really yeah. wonderful to be in a town that has held on to this store for so mm-hmm. long. The history is really very grounding for us. The store is more than just us. It's a whole lot of other people who came before.
And from the photographs I've seen, it looks like the building that the Yankee Bookshop is in is multi-storied. Are you only on the ground floor?
Well, yeah, we're on the first floor. The building itself, it's a three-level building. We just take up the first floor, yeah. and we have the basement. But as far as for retail space, it is just the first floor, which mm-hmm. you know, we cover what, how many square feet?
We're about 1,400 square feet.
That's a really nice size. Small enough that it feels intimate, but big enough that you can have a great selection of books.
Yeah. yeah. People are always surprised at how big we actually are because our store is L-shaped. So when you walk in, it looks like it just goes straight back. And then you reach a point where you can see around the corner and everyone goes, oh, more books.
They probably think they've stumbled across a secret room. Now, do you only sell new books or do you sell new and used books?
We sell primarily new books. We do have a few out of print books that we sell used. There's the perennial classic A Moose for Jessica, which is a story that happened just down the road and people ask about it all the time. So we try to keep used copies of that around.
As well as some of the books that Jane and Will Curtis published back in the 70s mm-hmm. on the history of Woodstock. And also they did a lot of nature writing. Will and Jane did writings about birding in your backyard. And they also wrote about Marsh Billings, the history of that national park. So mm-hmm. we've got those history books here too that are...
Yeah, yeah, and that park is walking distance from the store. So we try to, you know, if we have used books, it's because they're located or they're related to the area here.
And are you both from Vermont?
No, we're both transplants. I grew up in New York State, and I've lived in lots of different places and came to Vermont about a decade ago.
I grew up in New Jersey, but my grandparents moved to Vermont back in, they bought some land and built a house back in the late 70s and early 80s. So as a kid, I was always coming up here since about 1980. We'd come up in the winter, we'd come up in the spring, and we'd spend a lot of time in the summer. You know, they built a house on a good chunk of land at the base of a mountain. So that was always, you know, some of my fondest memories. When I finally moved here in about 2005, I was able to live on that land in that house for a couple of years. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Oh, that sounds beautiful. And did you meet each other in Vermont?
We did. We actually both used to work for Barnes & Noble. And so we met while working for them and became pretty fast friends. And when we left there, I left there to go back to graduate school and ended up getting a job at an independent bookstore, Phoenix Books, in Burlington, Vermont. And actually, it was the 5 years that I spent there, the owners of that shop were the ones who helped us become, you know, co-owners of this shop.
Now, we have listeners from all over the world, so I'm wondering if you can give us a short description of what you'd see when you drive into Woodstock, because it really seems like the quintessential New England town. It's gorgeous.
So as you're driving along Route 4 in Vermont, you're driving through this really heavily wooded area with lots of mountains in the distance. And if it's the right time of year and you're coming from the east, you actually see this lit up star on a mountainside. And that tells you that you're approaching Woodstock. And when you pull into Woodstock, it is pretty much the textbook definition of a beautiful New England village, complete with a town green and a wooden covered bridge and a beautiful inn and a lovely little, you know, downtown shopping area with all independently owned stores and you know, lots of bed and breakfasts. It's a really beautiful town to be in.
And do you have skiable mountains in that area?
We're right in the midst of, we've got several ski areas right in the, we've got Suicide Six, we're close to Killington, Okemo, mm-hmm. Who else is around? So we're right in the midst of all these skiing areas.
A national park right around the corner.
Sounds like a dream.
Kind of is. It's very surreal. It's still, we've been here for a few years and we're still, you know, like every morning, we still remark on how beautiful the drive to work is. Mm-hmm. And it's still to be amazed by that when you're living here daily is still, you know, it's very humbling.
And right now, everyone's put up all their holiday decorations and stuff too. So it is very much like a sweet little winter village right now.
In ordinary times, we would be having the Wassail festival coming up. I don't know if you've heard of this or know about it, but it is, it's all things.
If you love Christmas, Wassail is for you.
I definitely want to know more about this celebration.
So basically, all of the houses and businesses in town get completely decked out for the holidays. There's garland, there's lights, there's wreaths, there's all of that. There's usually a good amount of snow by now, although now this year we don't have any. But the weekend involves this really ornate Christmas parade where there's, I forget the name of the organization, but there's a horse club where people get their horses all decked out. And they wear period clothing from like the 1800s. So it's just this really beautiful transporting parade that comes through the town. And there's a Yule log lighting ceremony. And there's the lighting of the memory tree in town happens that night too. Yeah. It's just, and there's house tours, all of these beautiful old houses that get all decorated for the holidays. You can go through them and see all the beautiful stuff that they've done.
Well, just think how much you're going to appreciate it next year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's really, you know, missing it this year for sure, but it'll be that much better next year.
I spent some time on the WoodstockVT.com website and indulged myself in the historical section, specifically the pages on a haunted history. Do any of the ghostly stories have warrant?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, 2 years ago, we did have a woman named Thea Lewis came, and she's a Vermont author who writes about hauntings and spirits and all kinds of things. And she said there definitely was energy in our building. she said it was good energy. And we believe that for sure.
We haven't had anything too paranormal happen within our shop in the time. No.
But there are lots of stories from like the restaurant around the corner.
Yeah.
And
building the restaurant formerly known as Bentley's has a lot of paranormal activity, as it also at one time was a funeral home, correct?
It was, yeah. Our favorite story though is the Vampire of Woodstock. I don't know if that was on the website too.
Oh, I think our listeners would love to hear this story from you guys.
Well, yeah, so the story goes, this was in the mid 1800s. This was around the time that, tuberculosis was claiming a lot of people throughout Europe and also here in the States. And during that time of the unexplained deaths were attributed to vampirism or witchcraft. And there was a young man who passed away. I think he was in his early 20s, and they buried him in a local cemetery. A few weeks passed and his brother was overcome by illness. And I believe he also passed away. Mm-hmm. And this gave the fear that his brother had passed something on to him or his brother had come back as a vampire and struck his brother. So they actually, in those times to ensure, you know, they would oftentimes exhume the body and they would usually take the head off. Burn the heart. They would go to extreme measures, and they did all of this for this young man.
Yeah, there's documentation of a ceremony where they actually like burned the heart in a cauldron.
Where on, some of the
on
town,
the green.
It was kind of it was a public event, so a lot of the town elders were present during this ceremony, and they buried the heart. Again, rumor has it they buried it on the green.
Yeah,
right in town.
And they like buried the cauldron and put rocks on it and all that kind of stuff. And then years and years and years later, they came back and tried to dig it up and see if it was still there. And they can't find any trace of it.
Of the cauldron?
Of the cauldron. Yeah. There's no trace of the cauldron.
There was a movie in 1981 called Ghost Story that was partly filmed here in Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And this starred Fred Astaire. Who else was in it?
I think it was Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Melvin Douglas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They panned on Central Street, which features like the Woodstock Pharmacy. Our store at that time was featured in it with the big metal sign during the 1980s. There's a lot of, kind of ghostly happenings. It's, not on the level of, say, Salem, Massachusetts, with the witchcraft or anything like that. There's no necessarily evil here. It's just old historic.
Old New England town stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you listen to the essay I read at the beginning of this episode, you'll know that I definitely take notice of these synchronistic ghostly incidences that happen in our life. So yeah, I really enjoy hearing these kind of tales. But for now, I'd like to know about Bookstock. What is it and how is the Yankee Bookshop involved?
Last year was the 11th year of Bookstock. We are the official bookstore of Bookstock. We help with getting some authors, and we help attract people to the town. But essentially, it's grown. At first, it was just a used book sale, and they thought that it would be fun to have a couple authors come and talk. Now, every year, we are able to get around 40 different authors and poets to come and spend a weekend here in Woodstock. And it probably brings, to our little town of less than 3,000 people, it probably brings another 1,000. It's a weekend for book lovers. There's a giant used book sale. There's always a fantastic lineup of Vermont primarily and New England writers across all genres. We've got wonderful poets that come, but the poetry track attracts people from all over the country. Poets and prose writers, fiction and nonfiction, a lot of history. It's always wonderful to see what the lineup is every year. People get really excited.
And how many days is the event?
Kind of like 2.5 days. You got to cram in a lot of authors in that time. But we kind of take over the town. There's, 5 different locations where talks are happening simultaneously over the course of the day. We take over the town green with food vendors and book vendors and authors and different writing organizations. I think like the Mystery Writers of New England always has a table. I think the tagline that the original group came up with is the Green Mountain Festival of Words. Mm-hmm. And it is. There's a big art show that happens too, that's all things made of the written words. So I remember walking in one year and seeing this dress that was hanging in this window that was all made of book pages. Just really wonderful stuff. This year, we made the very difficult decision, the board of Bookstock, to go virtual with it because we didn't want to completely cancel it. And so we've had 3 different presentations so far. They've all done really well. And now people from across the country are able to attend, which is great.
That has actually been one of the positives that's come out of this awful pandemic. A lot of the indie bookshops holding virtual events are actually finding attendance is quite large, and they're having people tuning in from across the globe. So that's great.
Yeah.
And if any of our listeners would like to tune in to these sessions, what's the best way for them to do that, please?
You can go to bookstockvt.org.
Yes.
Bookstockvt.org. The next presentation is in this month. It's Nikita Stewart, who wrote about Girl Scout Troop 6000. And it's a fantastic story. She's a wonderful journalist, and we're really excited to virtually host her. Can't wait to hear her speak.
Now, getting back to the bookshop, what is the general age of your customers, and have you noticed a change in the age of readers during the pandemic?
Yes. So the average age of our town is around 60, 65. We serve an older population. Of course, when visitors are coming, the visitors are all over the map as far as age goes. But over the course of the pandemic, a lot of people have moved to Vermont, and a lot of them have been young families with children.
We've got a lot of families fleeing the cities from New York and Boston. Some of them already may have had like second homes or summer homes. Mm-hmm. When it became clear that it was safer to get outside of the cities, a lot of them decided to settle here for the time being until who knows how long it takes.
We're thrilled and excited. I mean, I've always loved helping children find books. And I mean, we were still able to do that by helping grandparents find books for their grandkids. But now we're seeing more and more young readers coming in, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. And fun too. I mean, there's nothing more fun than seeing kids get excited about books. That is my absolute favorite thing. Yeah.
And if a customer is unable to get physically into the store, are you able to put a gift basket together for them?
Yep. Yeah. I mean, we, especially with the holiday season coming up, we received a few different emails this week that were basically asking for just that. And we love, suggesting things that people might not know about or think of. I've got an email I've got to work on that's someone trying to find stuff for her 5 grandchildren, and we've got some regular customers of ours who live away from here, but come up here periodically, who have emailed and said, hey, I really want to put together a nice gift for my wife. You know what she reads.
It's these kind of relationships that give me hope for life after the pandemic.
Right.
Our lives are built around relationships. And I've heard stories over and over again of friends who haven't connected in years are now speaking to each other on a daily basis, something they would not have done pre-pandemic. So this gives me hope.
Yes.
With this in mind, is there one book that you can think of that has sold particularly well over the pandemic, or a certain genre?
Well, yeah, I mean, in the early days of the pandemic, we had a lot of the kind of dystopian fiction, such as Station 11, was selling well. And ironically, there was actually a lot of fiction that came out that the authors were, it recently was published, and then the pandemic happened, like Hamnet, like Pull of the Stars.
Have to do with plagues.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading Hamnet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one's on our list too. And then previous, but like Albert Camus' The Plague and The Year of Wonder,
by Gwendolyn Brooks.
Gwendolyn Brooks. And these are all like plague, pandemic.
A lot of people here really wanted to read more about plagues. Mm-hmm. Like the Great Influenza was huge for us. Because people just wanted some reference, some point of reference to kind of frame their thinking.
Mm-hmm. And to know that you could live through it and that other generations had lived through it too.
Yeah, how to be an anti-racist was huge. Cast has been massive.
Yeah. When the movement began in the summer, Black Lives Matter, Fire Next Time by James Baldwin is huge. How to be an anti-racist. D'Angelo's book.
White Fragility.
So it was people trying to understand and get an idea and become better humans and become activists, become involved. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
My hope is that we become a better educated and more empathic society.
That would be beautiful. And at least people are taking the effort, And so hopefully the lessons that we learned during the pandemic and every other movement, it will stick around. That's the true test.
And what do you both enjoy most about being booksellers?
Like what you were saying before, the experience of being a bookseller, especially during the year of 2020, the sense of community that we have in this place is amazing. We're very much overwhelmed by the community support that we have gotten. And it's not just the people who live here. It's the people who have visited and feel connected to here for whatever reason. We feel very fortunate that we get to do something that we love and that we're passionate about, and that all of these other people are supporting us to do that thing. And they, they feel that this bookstore is important to their community and they don't want to see anything happen to it. It's a very humbling experience, like you said, Christian. As someone who's moved around a lot, and Christian has too, having that sense of community is just such a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And I think for us too, we always, when we were regular civilians, we would love going to our local bookstore, our local library, our local record shop, the comic book store. We would love going there for the escape and for just all the stimulus and the stories and just to have that. And now to do that and be a place where other people can find that feeling is just, it's quite beautiful and very fulfilling. And to be able to be that place where people go for comfort, entertainment, ideas, friendship, connection. Definitely is, yeah. And I think that too is a big reward, is the connection, to be able to relate to the stories, to recommend a book that somebody is going to love that they didn't know anything about, that they didn't know they needed this book, that this book is going to change their lives, literally. A young kid get excited about a series, or if you introduce them to the first book in the series and then they come back and they're excited and they want more.
Yeah.
And for adults too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for adults too, who find a new series of books that they are so excited about. That is the biggest reward.
Yeah, the hand selling of books is a great experience for the seller and the customer.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I recently had Allison Hill, CEO of the American Booksellers Association, on the show, and she explained that when people shop locally, around 28% of the sale stays in their community from taxes. But when one buys a book from Amazon, that amount changes to about 4%. What's one of the best ways customers can support you during the pandemic? And are you signed up with IndieBound or Libro FM?
Yes, we're with Libro FM. We are a bookshop.org affiliate, but we also have our own website, which is an IndieBound website. And through that website, honestly, the number one way that you can help a business right now is to buy a gift card, because that's just the most direct way to make sure that business has funds to operate. We're lucky. We've had that website for a few years now. So we're learning more about it every day, and we're pretty practiced with it. But support your local indie. if there isn't a book that you want right now, a gift card is a great thing. Or, you know, utilize the bookstore to supply gifts for other people.
I equate waiting for a book in a series when I've ordered it to the steps in a romance. And you kind of want those steps to last a long time, or as long as they can. There's nothing like waiting for a book. And then when you get it, oh my gosh, just that opening it, sitting down, reading it, putting your feet up with your favorite cup of coffee or something is great.
Yeah. During the pandemic, people really stepped up and they supported local, the people who live in our immediate community and the people who have ties to the community. And then just also through our website, it would feel, maybe it's random, maybe they had, you know, friends of friends, but, you know, we would get orders from California, from down south, the Midwest, up and down the East Coast. It was really amazing the amount of support that we got. People would write little messages, you know, hang in there. And, you know, they're fed up with Amazon. They stated, you know, we would so much rather support you guys and we want to shop local. And I think some people also, they shared that love. They supported us and they supported other indie bookstores in their own community and they branched out. And things like Libro supports all indie bookstores. So it's come a ways. Indies are making a comeback. And through this, I think we're going to be stronger for it.
I agree. Now, Carrie, I noticed under the staff picks, you listed Catherine Arden's Winter Night Trilogy. I think I read the series 3 or 4 times. What did you enjoy most about the series?
Oh my gosh. There are a few series where I love all of the books equally all the way through. What I love about Catherine is, because she lives in Vermont, to meet her, she's just the most down-to-earth, lovely, wonderful person. We had an event here with her where we literally all sat in a circle and just shared stories because that's what it felt like a good idea to do. And her writing for adults is fantastic. And her writing for kids is fantastic. She writes these creepy stories for kids that are just so well done and so different. But the Winter Night Trilogy, I love fairy tale retellings and the kinds of books that dig into that and have all kinds of Easter eggs. If you know the mythology, then you're going to get even more out of that book. And those books are full of Easter eggs regarding Russian fairy tales and Russian history. So the writing is beautiful. It's incredibly transportive. And there's so much there if you know what to look for. So, yeah, I can understand reading them 3 times because you'll find new stuff every time.
And Christian, among your recommended reading, you list 2 of Brandon Stanton's books, Humans of New York and Humans. They look like great holiday gifts. Do you have both books in stock?
He's amazing. Yeah. We do have Humans and we've got Humans of New York here. And that's, you know, Humans of New York, we carry here regularly. New York City is just an amazing place and the way that he captured it. And especially, you know, some of Brandon's backstory too. He's not the perfect person. He wasn't, you know, he didn't go to photography school. He bought a, you know, crummy camera, his first one, and he just went out there and, you know, he got down with people people felt comfortable enough to tell him their stories. And, you know, I think that's some of the beauty in these moments with strangers too, is kind of a confessional. So he was capturing the story and then he was also able to capture the image of the people. Sometimes it's just the small details, you know, their hands or their shoes or, you know, but just the way that he captured it, it was just beautiful. And then to branch out, you know, New York City itself is such a melting pot with people from all over the world. For him to then step outside of New York City and then go out to the world at large, I think he covered a lot more places. Sometimes those people who were not lucky enough to be able to go escape their situation and come to America and live in New York City. So, but he captures such the raw beauty, the pain, that again is human. We're all humans and we all connect to that somehow. So, it's amazing work.
Yeah. I love to go to his page first thing in the morning on Instagram because it's inspiring. It makes me feel humble. It starts my morning with that attitude of gratitude. And the stories of the people give me hope too.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. It does. Like I said, it is hope. Whenever you need that reminder that things have been bad and people have been through worse. Yeah, it is. It's definitely, it's very grounding.
And speaking of grounding, Christian, you're a musician, correct?
I've played music throughout my whole life. Yeah.
And is there much of a music scene in Woodstock?
In normal times, yes, there is. There's a lot of music going on in the Upper Valley area in Vermont.
And are you still playing in a band?
Not at this moment, no. We were playing up until I was playing until the pandemic hit and things just kind of took a hold from there. And I think that's for a lot of musicians and other artists right now who did things communally. You can still do it solo. The creative process, it's weird. You know, sometimes you get writer's block or you just don't feel the inspiration to do it. Sometimes you're just too exhausted to find that creative spark that you need. There's a lot of burning creativity here in this area. I'm definitely inspired by the people who came before.
And what instrument did you play in the band?
I play bass guitar mostly. I played a little piano and trumpet, guitar and drums. And Carrie has gotten me a Shruti box for my birthday recently. So I'm taking on that.
And what's Shruti box?
It's an Asian instrument. It's similar to like a squeeze box or an accordion. It's a kind of a drone device where it's hand powered and you open or close the keys to get different pitch and tones. Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's used a lot for meditational practices, and it's a good kind of a droning. You can hit a note in the background and kind of play along with that.
Well, Christian and Carrie, you are just delightful, and I wish you all the best with the Yankee Bookshop, and maybe we can catch up again next year.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for doing this and all that you do.
My pleasure. If you're enjoying the Bookshop podcast, please consider becoming a patron. For more information, go to www.patreon.com/thebookshoppodcast. Or you can go to my website, mandyjacksonbeverly.com, click on the Bookshop podcast, and you'll find more information about me and the podcast there. From bookshop to author. Géza Tritalier was born in Budapest, Hungary, and escaped with his family in 1956 during the Hungarian Revolution, immigrating to Canada the same year. He grew up in Toronto, attending the University of Toronto Schools, where he was school captain. He graduated from Harvard University with a BA in Human Ecology in 1972, after taking a break in his studies to work as a host in the Ontario Pavilion at Expo 70 in Osaka, Japan. Géza was selected as a Rhodes Scholar from Ontario, attending Oxford University and graduating with a BA MA in Human Sciences in 1974. He completed his studies with an MSc in Economics from London School of Economics and Politics in 1975. Géza represented Canada as an AP fencer in the 1976 Olympic Games in Montreal. Géza is the author of 13 books, including thrillers, memoirs, poetry, and children's books. Hi, Géza, and welcome to the show.
Hello, Mandy. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, Géza. And I'm actually admiring the painting behind you.
Oh, it's a primitive painting of one of our houses. We lived in Larchmont for a while.
How funny. I recently interviewed Pauline Greeman, owner of Anderson's Larchmont Bookshop.
Oh, lovely. Yes, I know it. What a coincidence.
Yes, it is. Now, you've spent time living in different countries. How has each country influenced your style of writing, whether it be poetry, thrillers, children's stories, or memoir? Has each country taken you on a literary journey?
Yes, very much so. And each country has influenced my writing differently. Some have provided some great content, some great material. Others like Japan, where I lived for a year, really inspired me to write haiku and tanka, the Japanese form. So that's where I learned about that form and got into writing that in that genre. Living in Vienna, that gave me a lot of material for my thrillers, starting with Twisted Reasons, which is a bit of a takeoff on The Third Man, which takes place also in Vienna. The difficulties that we have with the Russian sphere of influence that plays into that novel and several of the other ones, which touch on some of the bad things that are coming out of Russia, for example, human trafficking and the whole nuclear proliferation issue. And now, latterly, I'm working on another novel, which is a sequel to actually my very first thriller, Arctic Meltdown, which it looks at the tremendous militarization that Russia has been doing in the Arctic and the potential for conflict there. So, yes, I've been influenced in many ways by everywhere I've lived.
And when you were in Japan, which area did you live in?
In Osaka, I worked at the World's Fair, Expo 70, and in fact, that is also the subject of one of my memoirs, the Expo Affair. The first memoir I wrote was about my family's escape from Hungary during the Hungarian Revolution and immigration to Canada. And then the second one was the Expo Affair. And the third one is the story of a Romanian-Hungarian fencer I helped defect to Canada when I represented Canada at the Montreal Olympics in 1976.
With fencing, correct?
Yes, yes. So again, that's partly, my fencing was partly influenced by being Hungarian because it's Hungary's national sport. So that's another influence that comes from one of my many homelands.
And when you were in Japan, were you able to visit Kyoto?
Yes, yes, yes. I love Japan. Kyoto is amazing.
Yes, one can't help but be inspired by the gardens alone.
They're so beautiful. They're so beautiful. So I had the fortune to be able to travel around. Basically, I hitchhiked quite a bit with friends up to Hokkaido across Honshu, and then took a motorcycle ride with another friend down to Kyushu and Shikoku. So I saw all of Japan in 1970, and it was an amazing experience because that was just when Japan was starting to emerge. So I just fell in love with the country. I've been back only once. We were supposed to be back actually just last month with my wife. We were going to go hiking there and for 50th anniversary of Expo 70, but we had to skip that because of what we're living through right now.
Sometimes it's hard to believe that it was only in, 1859 when Japan was opened up?
Yes.
In 2005, my husband and I took our two sons on a trip to Japan with members of our Aikido dojo in Culver City. We started in Osaka and spent time in Kyoto, and then we went to Hiroshima, and that was a life-changing experience. I think the world would think differently about nuclear arms if they were to see that place. So sad.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I went there. Yes. It's very moving. You know, it's an experience that everyone should have. Yes, I agree. So Japan has a lot to offer.
Yes, I agree. Writers tend to pull from experiences, whether they be images, smells, overhearing conversations, the touch of fabric. Do you have one sense that is stronger, that draws you into a story?
I think the visual is probably what's most important in my work, certainly my poetry. I think a lot of the images are clearly visual. And also I work that into my other genres, my thrillers and memoirs as well.
Do you take a lot of photographs so that you have the visual memory to draw from?
Not really. It's mostly memory. But I was just going to say that the other sense that I really get great pleasure out of is hearing, and I love music. And actually, my first poetry collection is called Cello's Tears because a lot of the poems in there were inspired by classical music. The first poem in there is Echoes, and it refers to the echoes of the cello. So,
and the book cover is really lovely.
Yes, I know. I really like that cover. It was published by a very small publisher in the South. And I love that publisher. It's Lucinda Clark at PRA Publishing, and they have published my first three poetry collections, and they're currently working on publishing my first short story collection. So I'm very pleased with working with them. They're great to work.
When I clicked on the homepage of your website, I was struck by the photograph or the image of the Danube and the government offices on the right. The image triggered a memory from my childhood. My parents raised the whole family to appreciate all styles of music. And one of my father's favorite pieces was the Moldo by Smetana.
I love it. Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Mine too. And when my father first played it to me, we listened to the entire piece, and then we went back and listened to it again. And he said, when you first hear it, what do you hear? And I said, I hear the snow melting and the little streams beginning. And then he took me through the whole growth of that piece with the river ending up, you know, in the ocean. And I've never forgotten that. And it reminds me of the power of creativity and imagination and how we are taken to these places, whether it be through visual arts, the written word, music, dance. They are our ticket to escape.
I agree. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's so important that, and that's partly why I keep writing, especially now in these troubled times when we're fighting climate change and the pollution. A lot of my most recent work, certainly my last two poetry volumes and the one I'm currently working on are largely to do with what we are doing to the world around us and to other species and to ourselves. And that's my currently my small contribution to try and get people to realize that we have to change the way we're living. And actually, I wanted to reference, I just recently saw David Attenborough's A Life on a Planet. I don't know if you've seen that, but that is a fabulous movie. And I think everybody should take the time to look at it because it's a pictorial, it is beautiful. The cinematography is fabulous, and the message in there is something that I'm trying to also communicate through my poetry and other works.
Let's talk about your book, Extinction, which is a collection of poetry, and your third book published by PRA Publishing. You divided this book into sections. Can you share with us your thoughts on that, please?
Well, the first section deals largely with what we are doing to the world around us. The second section is more to do with what we are doing to different species. And actually, I call many of those poems in that part my beastie poems. And then I also have beastie poems in my fourth collection and a few in previous collections and one I'm working on now. But they're to do with different forms of life, mostly animals in the animal kingdom, but some in the plant kingdom as well. And then the third part is how that's all impacting us, and it's more the personal aspect, how we are, what we're doing to ourselves. But also in that last part, I work some other more personal poems. It's similar in my fourth volume. It's similarly parsed, except I add another section there, which has to do with the pandemic, which to a large degree is also can be linked back to climate change and globalization and what we're doing, how we're living.
And in the foreword of your book, Extinction, poet Peter Fox Smith says, and I quote, "The wonder of the book, however, transcends the obvious gloom with the inclusion of poems detailing the incomparable beauty of our universe and the power of love to make human life a meaningful experience." Beautiful words. And now, of course, I want to go and read his poetry too.
Yes, he's an amazing poet. He actually just passed away last month, very sadly, with a brain tumor. And his poetry is not known, unfortunately, but I think he's one of the greats in American poetry, and his poetry should be known. And I love the man dearly. He was an acolyte or a teaching assistant to Robert Lowell at Harvard, and then he became known here in Vermont as an announcer on VPR, the public radio, for opera. He wrote a book about opera. He's a very cultured and knowledgeable person. But anyways, he was so kind as to write that foreword for my book.
I'd like to read Witching Hour, which is the first poem in your book, Extinction. Is this the witching hour, the turning point, when the simmering seas boil, spill across the cauldron's brim to flood this verdant earth? Corpses of frogs and fish, seals and birds, our detritus, plastics and rotting hulls, wash up with the silt to bury my feet. Is this the witching hour, the turning point, when wildfires spread, raging across the land, and consume forests and fields, roads and towns, killing with burning heat and acrid smoke all life they find in homes or barns or nests, or frantically fleeing the fated end? Is this the witching hour, the turning point? We know damn well it is, but do nothing. We continue our hedonistic lives, complicit in destroying our one earth.
It's wonderful. You read it wonderfully.
Thank you. And it's easy to read such beautiful poetry. Now, do you remember where you were when you wrote this poem and what year?
I think I was here in Vermont, actually. Yes. And I think it must have been 2017 when I wrote it. So a few years back. But I was very concerned with where we're heading and what it all means.
And would you be so kind as to read us one or two of your own poems, please?
Well, I could either read one which is, I guess, in line with some of the stuff we're talking about right now, or there's one which is much more personal, which is also in Extinction. Well, maybe I'll read the more personal one, which is from Extinction. And this poem is called When I Die. When I die, who will grieve for me? Who will shed tears when the bell tolls? When I'm no longer conscious, no longer feeling and loving, will you, dear, kiss me one last time? Hold my ice-cold hand to your heart. And when my body burns to ashes or decays, devoured by maggots, how long, love, before you forget my face, my voice, my touch, my laugh? When you walk through the fall forest, swim in our pond below the falls, will you remember our delight, sharing such sunny summer days? And when you lie alone at night, or naked in another's arms, will you still evoke our great love, the ecstasy of our coupling? When our children come from afar, over dinner and lots of wine, will you smile as you reminisce about my quirks, faults, and foibles? When you play with our grandchildren, sing them a song, kiss them goodnight, will you gently remind them, dear, that I love them with all my heart? And as you read these my poems, my cello's tears, sotto voce, will you try hard to remember the joy of our life together? For there will be no more of me, only what is left in your heart. So the reference there to cello's tears is to the first collection of poetry, which we talked about. So.
And what a beautiful reading. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Not as good as yours.
Oh, nonsense. You know, one of the real delights in hearing a poet read their words is listening to the silence between lines.
That's great. Thank you.
And this is a great reason to love technology. I mean, your grandchildren's children are going to be able to listen to you read your own poetry.
Yes, yes, yes. No, that's a fantastic thing that these times can be recorded and other people can see them worldwide. And as you say, into the future as well. And
Your book, titled For the Children, is a narrative memoir that tells a story of your family's escape from Hungary and immigration to Canada in 1956. I've got a few questions here. When did you begin writing this book, and what year was it published? What age were you when your family escaped Hungary and arrived in Canada? And how did you feel the first time you returned to Budapest?
Well, wow, those are quite a few questions. Okay, I'll start with the first one. I started writing probably in my mid-20s. I initially thought that the thought initially was that I would write it down for my children to have and for my wife and friends to have. And then I left it, put it aside, hoping eventually to do something with it. And then once retired from my other life, my business life, I had the leisure time to start working on writing, and that's when I polished it and did some of the research for the historical context, brought that into the narrative, and found a publisher. It was published in 2015. I sent it to a lot of publishers, and eventually Édition Dédicace, which is a French-Canadian publisher, their U.S. operation published it. It's not one of my favorite publishers, but they published the book, so I'm glad for that. And then you asked, how old was I when I escaped, when we escaped? Well, I was 7 years old, and I remembered the story like a movie initially, and visually. And this is, again, gets back to your question of which sense is important. I remembered the events like a movie, and then eventually set them down in words. We went to Canada. We first went to Austria. We were caught twice. The third time we got out and got to Austria, and then getting to Canada was also a bit of a tough thing. Finally we got there, and my parents raised us there. And actually the book is called For the Children, because they wanted to escape Stalinist Hungary for the children, to give them a better life for their children in the country where freedom reigned, and we would have the opportunities. And I'm forever thankful to them and for that. When I first went back, actually I was the first one in our family to go back. It was in 1967, the summer of 67. I was doing a trip throughout Europe, and it was still very communist then. And I visited my grandmother, who was still living there. And then I went back several times after that when I was at college, especially when I was in England at Oxford. I went back from there, and I had already started fencing for Canada. So they sent me to a number of competitions in Hungary. So I enjoyed going back in those days. And then actually we went back to live there as a family in 1999 with my wife and two children. And we lived there for 5 years.
In Budapest?
In Budapest, yes. Because I wanted to go back and see if I could help build a modern economy, the democratic system there. And after 5 years, I left a little bit in disgust with all the corruption that was still going on. So we moved to Vienna, but I still traveled back quite often.
Well, Vienna is a beautiful, beautiful city.
It's my favorite place in the world. It's where I felt the most at home, combining with my Western and my Central European background. So,
and why did you leave?
Well, we were in Vienna for 5 years, and it was partly the financial collapse of the world, the financial doldrums the world was entering into, and also my father was passing away in Canada, so there was some thought that we should go there. Eventually, we ended up going to live in Uruguay. And part of the reason we didn't go back to Canada was because of health insurance issues. And I had a great health insurance scheme with my former employer, and I could keep that as long as I didn't go back to Canada or come to live in the U.S. So we decided we would stay out of North America, and a friend from Uruguay said, well, why don't you come to South America? And I thought, why not? It's a great opportunity to discover another part of the world. And so we did that, stayed there for 2 years and traveled around Latin America, and then went and lived in Bordeaux, France, where my wife had spent some time as a student, again, for me to explore another part of the world. And I had some business interests still in Vienna, so Uruguay is a bit too far to be able to carry those out, but Bordeaux seemed like a good place, so we went there.
And how wonderful that you've been able to share these adventures with your family. Your wife must be a special lady.
Yes, she is. She likes, we've had a good life. We must say we've seen a lot of the world and enjoyed a lot of great experiences.
And what music inspires you? I'm guessing because you've traveled all over the world, you've had a chance to explore different styles of music.
Absolutely. I love a lot of Mahler's work. Franz Liszt, of course, being Hungarian, I love his work. Basically, everything in the classical genre played pretty well. I also love jazz and rock and roll and some other kinds of music. But it's really more the classical pieces that have inspired my work and my poetry. For example, several of the pieces in Cello Stairs were inspired by pieces by Mahler, and there's one that was inspired by Ravel. We heard Richard Strauss.
Was it Liszt who incorporated a lot of folk songs into his music?
Yes. Well, he wrote a lot of Hungarian rhapsodies. I mean, he didn't write the music, but he used that folk music in his pieces. A lot of his music, for that reason, I love it's Hungarian. And Brahms did too. Brahms used a lot of Hungarian music in the Hungarian dances. And of course, Bartok and Kodály, that's all Hungarian.
And some of that music has such a melancholia about it. I was recently doing some research on Budapest and, well, Hungary during the First World War. Oh, just a tragic history.
Yeah. No, it's the First World War for Hungary was a real watershed. Hungary did quite well under the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as part of the Habsburg Empire, as the other half, not the Austrian half, but the other half of the empire. And then the First World War, I think, really hit it hard. And of course, they ended up on the losing side, so they lost 2/3 of their territory, and a lot of Hungarians of my parents' age have never been able to live that down. And of course, then there were there was the interwar period when there was some fascist elements that were starting to rise. And then the Second World War was devastating in many ways for Hungary. And then the Russians took over, and they call the Russian liberation of Budapest and the bombing of Vienna, but actually the Russians destroyed much more of Budapest than the Americans did of Vienna. So,
well, I've not been to Budapest, but it is definitely on my list.
It's worthwhile, and if you love music, the music is fabulous there.
Let's talk about your writing. Do you plan out your stories before you begin writing, or do you know the beginning and the end and go from there and research as you write?
For my fiction books, I usually do an outline, so I have a vague idea of where I'm going. But then once I start writing, the story takes on a life of its own and goes in different ways. And sometimes it's quite far removed from where I started out wanting to go. But usually there are different elements that get introduced along the way, new characters that I didn't envision that I may need to fill some niche. So it's fun. I mean, that's partly what I love about the creative process is creating a story like that and then doing some research, which then impacts the story in a certain way that you didn't envision, and then it takes it in a different way. The Twisted Trilogy, which is, I guess, the three books that's basically start out in Vienna. I started writing them in Vienna. It's just that. I mean, it's basically a trilogy of books, of stories that came out of trying to do a takeoff on The Third Man, as I said earlier, and then it all blossomed into a much, much bigger thing.
Yes, it seems that when the characters realize they have a voice, the stories seem to take on a life of their own.
Right, exactly. And a lot of the creative process, I find, is during the night. I mean, sometimes if you have a problem, you can't resolve it. It's best just to leave it. And I sometimes that very night or some other evening or on a long walk with your wife, suddenly there's a new element that allows it to suddenly take off again in a different direction. So I find writing poetry very stimulating, but it's a totally different kind of experience for me as opposed to writing fiction. I find the beauty of writing poetry to be in creating with just structuring words and sentences, putting them together, whereas in fiction or in my thrillers, it's really creating the whole world, the whole world around people and a story and a plot. So it's a different process, but equally satisfying, I find.
And in your September newsletter on your blog, you spoke of monumental tragedies related to climate change and self-serving tyrants as world leaders. You've been aware of language such as greenhouse gases for decades as you studied with Professor Roger Revelle, one of the first scientists to point to the damaging effects of greenhouse gases at Harvard in the early 70s. Does writing help soothe your anger and frustration while we continue to fight for our planet as some world leaders still deny science? I couldn't help think of this after I finished reading Witching Hour.
It's more the, it's more out of an expression of the frustration I feel, and then trying once I create something beautiful out of that, yes, there is satisfaction, but it's satisfaction in that I've created something out of that which is beautiful, but it's not satisfaction in the sense that we've gone to any resolution of the issues I'm trying to address or we're trying to address. So yes, there is some element of relief in there, but it's not. It doesn't really solve the issues, and that's an ongoing frustration.
Some days it's just really hard to keep your head up and hopeful. But the one thing I will say is this: I look at my sons and I look at their friends, many of whom are making a difference. They've known about the danger of climate change since they were little, and they're concerned that still not enough has been done about it, especially in our country. I don't want to put pressure on these kids. I'm just saying that they do give me hope.
I mean, my son, Nicholas, who is working with a renewable energy fund in Africa, bringing renewable energy to different parts of Africa. So that's very satisfying. And as we know, there's Greta Thunberg, who's been very, very vocal on these issues and a beacon for us all. No, it's really, there's some hope in the younger folk, but I think my generation is at fault to a large degree. And when I see some politicians still not wanting to address the fossil fuel issue, that the coal and oil and the gas are pollutants and causing to a large degree climate change, and that's a real heartbreaker, and that's got to change. I mean, we just have to change that, and that's where we as individuals can have a role to play to bring about that change. I mean, everybody has a vote in this, certainly in this country and in other countries, and they should be voting in the right direction to change that. There are people like David Attenborough, whom I mentioned, who at 94 are doing amazing things in terms of getting the message across. And I think all of us have a role to play in trying to do that similarly.
And for the people who are trying to find their voice, find your creativity. I truly believe in the power of the arts to make change. If you look throughout history, it has done just that. So paint, write, draw, compose music. We need you right now.
Right. That'll help change things, hopefully.
Geza, do you have one more poem you could share with us?
Sure. No, I'd love to. And actually, it's a good one to, I guess, end on, because it brings together a lot of the subjects we were talking about, music and this issue of climate change and other things. But this poem was inspired by a wonderful piece of music by Johann Strauss. It's his Woditz Tonenblumen Waltz, Where the Lemons Blossom. And I heard it, I guess, last, just a New Year's Day in the Vienna New Year's Eve concert. And it just inspired me to write this little poem. It's called Where the Lemons Blossom, Wo die Zitronen blühen. Lemons still blossom, and not just in Italy. They thrive in Assam, in Burma and Persia, as well in California and Florida. You can hear Strauss's Wo die Zitronen blühen waltz today on your iPhone anywhere in the world. Or read the novel by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, his masterpiece, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship. You can delight in Manet's exquisite still life, Le Citron, painted in 1880. But will lemons, will anything still bloom anywhere when man-caused climate change ravages this planet? Will we be around to appreciate this fruit, so perfect, its blossom's beauty, its taste's darkness, and the wonder of the sublime art it inspired? So that's one of the poems in my fourth collection, Extinction Rebellion.
Your poetry is haunting, and I'll remember that one whenever I go out to my lemon tree. Geza, I've thoroughly enjoyed speaking with you, hearing you recite your poetry, the stories of your life. Thank you so much. It's just been wonderful.
I have too. Thank you very much for this opportunity and for getting to know you. It's great to do that, and hopefully we'll be in touch again.
That would be lovely. You take care.
Stay safe and well.
And thank you for listening. Remember, buy local, read global, support your local indie bookshop. I'll see you around the corner. For updates about the show, make sure to follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Mandy Jackson Beverly.